Thank you, Mr. Holloway, and good morning, everybody. I bring you greetings from the crew in Buffalo. As you're going through your prayers and considering the brethren, remember our crew up there too. We have a number. I know an email went out. I shuffled a few things to Mr. Lambert this week, and so if you would remember Marty Turkowitz, probably most of you have seen the email about him. If you know Marty, Marty does most things with gusto. Given the fact that he can't see, most of us would be very cautious. Yes, that's the right word. You know, very, very, almost anxious about. And yet he juts around a room, and so we had real heavy thunderstorms coming in on Monday night, I believe it was. And Marty's parents weren't home, so he's listening to something on the radio. He didn't want to miss that, so he rushed out of his room. And just about 8 feet from his bedroom door, he's got a flight of 9 stairs that goes down to the main part of the home. And Marty tends not to like to use a cane or handrails. So Marty was half distracted, thinking about getting all the windows closed, listening to his radio, caught that first step a little faster than he should have, and his momentum carried him over the top. So he went, you know, with his hands in front, he went down 9 stairs, landed on his right side, managed to hit the roll and hit the TV stand and push that and knock lamps and everything else over, knock pictures off the wall. But he's, other than some bruising and all, he didn't have a problem, but he's got this intermittent shooting pain, like you might have a cracked rib or something like that. So he's not sure what it is, but he said every once in a while he was talking to me on the phone, and we'd be talking along, and he'd go, ooh, 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 ooh. Okay. Oh, and then it's gone. So it's just this real short pain. But again, please remember him. You always wonder what internal damage there might be, even though superficially it doesn't look like a lot. So remember Marty, please. Ellie Vera lost her son about a week and a half ago. They had the family memorial this week. I spoke to her during the week. She said things went very well, but still, anytime there's a loss in the family, please remember her in your prayers. She had a son in Georgia. She has a son down in Texas, and so she's a great distance from all her kids. So we are her family, so remember her, please. The Lord, certainly, having lost Mike Harrigan, having lost my dad last fall, you recognize all the little songs and pictures and thoughts and places that bring family back, so remember them. And then finally, something you might not be aware of, Betty Wise had dental surgery on Wednesday afternoon, I believe it was. She had 3 wisdom teeth pulled all at one time, and so we don't expect that she's in church this week more, nor maybe next week as well. So please remember Betty. She's got her son Don to take care of her in that, but I imagine that's not a pretty and enjoyable thing for anybody, anytime, anyhow. So please remember her. All right. I have my opening question here. I expect is going to get a little bit more feedback than it did in Buffalo, and you'll understand that in a moment, because in our Buffalo congregation, half of the congregation is under 15 years of old, so or 15 years of age. So when I asked this initial question, I saw a lot of looks that they, you know, you had to go back a few years on this. How many of you remember the television series, The $6 Million Man? Okay, I thought we might have a little bit more here. Actually, that, you know, we all do our age when we do that, because it ran from 1974 to 1978. I didn't realize it was quite that many years ago. But it was based on the storyline of an astronaut named Steve Austin who was involved in a near-fatal accident. And given the fact that he worked for a government agency and they have access to all kinds of resources, all they decided that they were going to be able to give him some gadgetry, to give him some special things. And as you saw the opening visuals and sound, you know, you saw the accident, and then you heard the beeping of the hospital monitor and that type of thing. And then you heard this deep voice come on and it goes, "We can rebuild him. We can make him better than he was." And so they gave him a, you know, a bionic arm, and they gave him legs that could run 60 miles an hour, and they gave him his left eye, I think it was, that had like a 20 power zoom lens and could see at night and all. Really cool stuff if we could pick those up off the shelf at Walmart. But the concept of building that ideal person is not new. In 1883, Italian author Carlo Collodi wrote a book entitled The Adventures of Pinocchio, about a wooden puppet that came to life. And the story wasn't necessarily a good one at the beginning, but this young man developed into a better person and then had the relationship with Geppetto. In 2001, there was a movie entitled AI, and that stands for Artificial Intelligence, and it was the same concept, way out in the future when population issues and all kinds of issues here on Earth, they've developed the opportunity to have these extremely capable artificial intelligence, robots, if you will, that become companions and even family members. And the story is about a young boy or a young robot who is used, and he's trying to find that humanity and find his place. There's a couple of movies made for the Stepford Wives, done the same way. I know there was a recent one with Nicole Kidman where there's this secret about the wives in this little community. It's called the Stepford Wives. And then, of course, we have Star Trek, if anybody's a Trekkie fan, with Data, you know, the android that is created with incredible wisdom and logic and strength and the ability to follow what sometimes challenges human beings, a set of rules and programming and the law, if you will, and understand that very clearly and live along his way, along his life, or his time, I guess you would call it. If we could build an ideal person, what would they look like, and how would they act? Again, as I mentioned, the concept of building a good person with strong character and all the right qualities isn't something that is new, nor is it something we've covered a lot of things that are in regard to the make-believe here, the fictional, but it's not just in the world of make-believe. In some of the darkest days of World War II, when General Douglas MacArthur was stuck in or headquartered in Australia, he often thought about the need for character, and he thought about the young son that he had, and he wrote down a prayer, and that prayer has survived down through time, and it's called Build Me a Son. I'd like to read it to you as we consider the question I asked a moment ago. If we could build that ideal person, what would they look like, and how would they act? Again, this is Build Me a Son by General Douglas MacArthur. It says, build me a son, O Lord, who will be strong enough to know when he is weak and brave enough to face himself when he is afraid, one who will be proud and unbending in honest defeat and humble and gentle in victory. Build me a son whose wishbone will not be where his backbone should be, a son who will know you and that to know himself is the foundation stone of knowledge. Got that a little bit messed up, but lead him, I pray, not in the path of ease and comfort, but under the stress and spur of difficulty and challenge. Here let him learn to stand up in the storm. Here let him learn compassion for those who fail. Build me a son whose heart will be clear, whose goal will be high, a son who will master himself before he seeks to master other men, one who will learn to laugh, yet never forget how to weep, one who will reach into the future, yet never forget the past. And after all these things are his, add, I pray, enough of a sense of humor so that he may always be serious, yet never take himself too seriously. Give him humility so that he may always remember the simplicity of true greatness, the open mind of true wisdom, and the meekness of true strength. Then I, his father, will dare to whisper, I have not lived in vain. So General MacArthur recognized this need for a higher level of person, a stronger character, a person of integrity. Again, I'll ask, if we could build that ideal person, what would they look like and how would they act? In the remaining time of the sermon today, I'd like to take a relatively short chapter in the Bible that addresses the attributes that a truly outstanding person must have. This concept of build me a son is not new either, because we know that right from the beginning, for thousands of years, God has been doing that with a select group of mankind, and the ultimate goal of all of them. And so we'll go through that using this chapter as a backdrop. The chapter we'll turn to a moment is one that you know very well. It's a passage that we sing of, one of the well-known hymns that we sing. One of the things that I find interesting is that in only a handful of verses, in fact, in only 99 words, we're provided with a provocative and important question to open. We're provided with a succinct bullet list of answers, which then say, that person looks like this and acts this way, and then an amazing promise for those that live their lives according to that instruction. What I find equally interesting is that each and every item in that list addresses how people interact with people. Each of us is an imperfect individual striving for a higher level, and yet we have to interact every day with many equally or more so imperfect individuals. And so often when we read certain passages in the Bible, we struggle. You know, we we try to, what does it mean to me? How do I see it? How do I look in a mirror each day and see that list and then stack myself up at the end of the day against those lists? Because some of them are very profound. They're very deep. And when you sit there and start thinking about, you know, some particular points, again, it's not that we can't get that definition, but sometimes we struggle to put it into things that we can do and say and see and understand and implement in our life every day. And yet this particular verse certainly has that higher spiritual level to consider, and yet each and every point here deals with our interaction with other people. And that's something that we can look at and evaluate. Pray about when we get up in the morning, but then evaluate hopefully several times during the day as, you know, as that person comes into our office and we have a particular conversation about something. You know, maybe production in the plant is not up to snuff. Maybe that person made a mistake and we lost a customer. You know, as we interact with people, sometimes in sensitive situations, as they walk away or as we do, we need to be asking ourselves, did I live up to the checklist in this particular verse or this particular chapter? So that's the way that we can really help. You know, when we get on our knees before God, we're on our P's and Q's. We're on our best behavior. We're recognizing Him. We've shut out. I appreciated Mr. Teague's opening prayer where it says, you know, help us to shut out those other things, the distractions, the concerns, the anxieties that we have of this world. And as we sit here today in this bubble of a room in a peaceful country on a beautiful afternoon, we need to be able to push those things out of our lives. And yet every day those things encroach on our mentality. They, you know, when you're in the middle of doing something and you're kind of stressed and somebody walks in the door, you're like, last thing I need is another distraction, something else to take those few minutes that I don't have. And yet when that person walks away, we need to get this list out. And we said, how did I do? Oop, just messed up on that one. Oop, just fell short on that one. And each and every day, those are the things that we need to work at and we need to understand and we need to try before we even get off our knees in the morning to say, Father, help me to make sure. I know that person, next office over, I don't get along with the best. There's certain things that irritate me, and I'm sure there's things about me that irritate them. But help me to see each and every action during the day and each and every relationship during the day that I'm doing better. Again, when we've got to deal with some gruff taxi driver, you know, when I think of Mr. Lambert halfway around the world in an area with different money and an area with different language and with different customs and different food and not getting the sleep, I wouldn't be the sunniest person to deal with probably at that point in time. So I think we can all put ourselves in that situation, and those are the type of things where we need to think about that in the morning, pray about that in the morning after we've gotten that list of our congregation in, and then say, okay, now wait a minute. Father, I've recognized you and I've recognized my brothers and sisters, and now I need to take a moment for somebody that needs a lot of help, and that's me. And so please help me today to work better with this list. The inconsiderate neighbor that doesn't clean up after his puppy, the highway department driver who's taken your mailbox down for the third time this winter, those are the times that we don't relate as well. Those are the times we don't put on that happy face. And that's where this particular list helps us interact with the people around us. Turn with me to the 15th chapter of Psalms, please. And you should probably put a marker there because we're going to take short trips away from this chapter, but we're going to come back and we're going to cover it in detail. I'd like to begin by reading it in its entirety. As I mentioned, there's only five verses, matter of fact, and 99 words, depending on which translation you're reading from. But we'll take short trips, but we'll come back here and we'll cover it in detail. I'm going to read first from the Revised Standard Version, and we'll read through again all five verses, and then we'll come back and we'll look at the individual verses. Matter of fact, we'll look at the individual traits and qualities of the individual and try to make sure that we can really equate them to how it acts or works in our life, to understand the particular words, how they were written, how they were explained, and how would they relate to an individual, and then say, yeah, that happened to me last week or last month, or I hope that never happens to me because I know I will struggle with that. Certain particular point. Psalm chapter 15 and verse 1. It says, a psalm of David. O Lord, who shall sojourn in thy tent? Who shall dwell on thy holy hill? I mentioned, there's your opening question. Verse 2. He who walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks truth from his heart, who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his friend, nor takes up a reproach against his neighbor. in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change, who does not put out his money at interest and does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. I mentioned earlier, we are opening with a question. We're given a bullet list of qualities that this person looks like and that we need to strive for, and then we're given an amazing promise at the end of that. Let's go through the chapter verse by verse. More specifically, as I mentioned, we'll look at the individual character traits that this model person, this model citizen, if you will, that will dwell on God's holy hill needs to have. Let's take it from the top then. Verse 1. It refers to the fact that it's a Psalm of David. So here we see a poem or a prayer that would have been set to music. These are the personal musings of King David. Now, I don't know where he goes, where he went, when he was deep in thought, when he was, you know, just considering, thinking out loud to himself maybe. But these are the musings of King David, one of the better-known servants of God. And he asks in the opening question, he said, Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? And who shall dwell in your holy hill? Again, think about this as we look at these different aspects, as we read the questions and see the promises. The question is, if we could build, or if that ideal person were to be built, developed, contrived, what would they look like and how would they act? Again, King David may be sitting on his rooftop looking at the stars as the sun's going down or as the sun's coming up. He may be sitting quietly in his throne room considering what this was. I don't know where it was. But one of the interesting things to begin with is that despite his education, despite his experience, despite his wisdom and his worldly experience, he doesn't begin to believe that he has the formula. So he goes and asks a very deep question, and he goes to the source of that knowledge. He says, Father, what does that person look like to you? And when we take a moment to look a little closer, we realize how truly far-reaching that question is, how truly wise and well-crafted that inquiry is. David doesn't allow for a passive answer because it's probing in nature here. He asks about the person that it would require, the type of character that would be required to have an intimate and long-term perpetual relationship with God. So you can't answer this question by saying, they've got to be 6'2", 245, and run the 100 in 9.1. That list is not sufficient. We're talking about something that really gets down to the core, what this person is going to act like under pressure, and by extension, how we all need to develop. The term here, again, about dwelling and abiding and sojourning is something that's long-term. In the physical sense, I got to slow down here because I'm tripping over my tongue. In the physical sense, we can relate this to the marriage relationship. This is not a casual visit. This is not stop by for a beer and watch a football game. This is something about who is going to dwell with you. What's the type of personality that you relate to, that you meld with, that you interact with? On a day when you're not feeling that strong, that comes alongside you and strengthens you, that picks up the things that you drop. We're talking about a perpetual, long-term, close, intimate relationship. As I mentioned, the marriage-type relationship, till death do us part. This is a permanent thing. David asks again, what type of person will you consider worthy to be in your family? What type of person will you invite to live with you for all eternity? Just a side note, David repeats this question or asks the same question again in chapter 24 and verse 3. So we won't go there again, but you can recognize that through this book of Psalms, David asks a lot of questions, and he asks them over and over again. Having gone through a particular trial or success, he asks a particular question and then muses on and looks for God's inspiration in order to bring us the story, to bring us the description about how it is we should be looking at that same question and developing in our lives. In verses 2 through 5, then, we see the portrait of this upright person whom God would reside with, the type of person that would be invited to dwell with God. Remember, again, as we go through these verses, that David focused on the kind of relationship that needs to be maintained with others. We know that the commandments are broken down into a group that explains or clarifies how we interact with God. And then there's a group of how we interact with mankind. And this one focuses on that latter. But the character that it takes to relate to either one really becomes the core. It's the fabric of what this person does and says and thinks. Let's look into the description that King David was divinely inspired to provide us here. When we look at a valuable gemstone, if any of you have ever bought diamonds particularly, one of the things they'll talk about is the clarity, the beauty, the facets. And when you look closely at a gemstone, you see that rainbow because of the way the light hits it and the way that it reflects and refracts off that. And so as we look at these five verses, we're looking at really at that type of description about if you were to look closely at this individual and look closely at yourself, what qualities should you see? What benefits and what beauty should be reflected from within? And so again, let's look at that as we get into verses 2 through 5. What does this ideal person, what does this model citizen of God's holy city look like? Verse 2, the first point it says that he walks uprightly. It doesn't mean that he stands straight and has good posture. The term walk here really refers to behavior or character or the way in which a person lives. And it then describes it as upright. The term is actually Strong's number 8549. For those of you that like the technicality of going through Strong's and the concordances and the Bible dictionaries to get definitions. And the word is tamim. And it has a very full description, actually. It's described with words such as integrity. So again, you know, when we look at, you say a person of integrity, immediately you have a particular facets of a person's, you know, honesty and accountability and things like that come to mind. So this word tamim, upright, says integrity. It talks about truth. It says this person's character is without blemish. The person is complete, full, perfect, sincere. Their nature is sound. They are without spot. They're undefiled or whole. So what we see in this one little word, upright, is, again, the many facets of what that really means. And then, of course, you could consider, and if you have somebody that brings to mind, a particular example, you can think of situations where you saw somebody particularly shine, where somebody was put to the test, where somebody was tempted, or somebody was pushed in back into a corner, and they performed according to this type of definition of upright. And that's what it brings to mind, and that's how we can extend and think of the facets of what this upright really means. This person is one that walks upright, according to the condition of the covenant that was made, that God made with his people. We can see what the instruction was, what the caveat was between God and Abraham when that first covenant was made. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1. Here this word tamim talks about a person of integrity. It talks about being without blemish, complete, full, perfect, sincere, and sound, and so on. And we see some of that, and we see instruction about that here in January. I guess it's the first book in the first month. I think I made that exact same error last week. Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1. And here's another thing that I found interesting, because we talked about the fact that this chapter, Psalm 15, has 99 words. And here in Genesis 17 and verse 1, it says, "And when Abram was 90 years old and 9, the Lord appeared to Abram and said unto him, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be you perfect." Now we know that a human being cannot be, will not be in our current state perfect. But what he was saying was this same word back here that says, be a person of integrity. Be a person who's dependable, that is going to speak the truth. Be complete, be sincere, be undefiled, keep yourself clean of the temptations and the troubles around you. Be whole. So walk before me and be you perfect. Verse 2 goes on to say, and I will make my covenant between me and thee and will multiply thee exceedingly. So the first explanation we see here in verse 2 says that this person walks uprightly. And we've tried to build on the picture and the word so that we can understand a little more closely what that means. And so again, as we drop back each day or each conversation or interaction that we have, and we look at this list and say, did I perform uprightly today? And so when our blood pressure got a little bit elevated, when our tone of voice maybe got a little bit terse, we have to recognize, close the door, Father, for a minute. I didn't perform as well as I would like and as well as you would like recently here. Help me with the next one, please. The next descriptor of this model citizen is that they work righteousness, which in simpler terms mean that they practice or are committed to doing what is right. Godly character has been described as something or someone who is consistently doing the right things at the right time, in the right way, for the right reason. So it says that this person walks uprightly and they work righteousness. Again, that description was somebody who consistently does the right thing at the right time, in the right way, for the right reason. And that would, to some degree, encapsulate this person of Psalm 15. So for this model citizen, for you and me as well, godly character is founded on a strong sense or belief in an absolute standard of right and wrong, an absolute moral authority, which is something that we know that this world is lacking. And that's the type of person that God's been looking for, and those are the type of things that he's looking for in his sons and daughters as he looks to expand his current family of two. Finally, in verse 2 here, we are told that this person will be one that speaks the truth in their heart. Speaks the truth in their heart. This person really is the spokesperson or the poster child, if you would, for truth. They don't whisper that something is wrong. They would turn their back, but they don't simply turn their back on what is wrong. They pronounce the fact, they state the fact that there is inequity here, that there's something that's not right. And so again, this person speaks the truth from their heart, not only when it's convenient, but again, they're the person that speaks up on behalf of a situation that's not right, and certainly on behalf of an individual who is being taken advantage of. So the person speaks truth in their heart in all situations. They're the champion of those who have been wronged, bold in standing up for right, because they have the responsibility to set the record straight. They recognize that it should be set straight, that those things are not to be ignored. That's the easy way out that so many people take nowadays. And I have to admit that I've taken it too. Sometimes you look at the heat that's coming down on somebody else, and you're like, you know, it's not right, but I don't necessarily want to redirect that heat at me. And so, you know, we look at it and say, well, I'll go over here quietly and then I'll pray that person's going to... No, we should step into the gap. When we know what's right and wrong, do we speak the truth? Do we step in the middle of that fight that's going on and say, wait a minute, with all due respect, we have to recognize that authority, with all due respect, that's not right, or that's not true, or you don't have the full story. And especially if we're in a position to take that heat and the other person isn't, we need to be willing. That's that character. That's that righteousness. That's that truth in your heart that says, I'm going to set this situation straight. The person we begin to see here in Psalm 15 really is what they profess to be. They speak the truth from their heart, and we know that out of the heart, the mouth speaks, and it practices and it lives what is inside. You can't hide that. Eventually, that comes out. And so again, this person speaks the truth. At their very core, at their very fiber, they are this person of righteousness and truth and uprightness. You know, this person begins to sound like the friend I want to have at my side when my back's against the wall. On those days where I'm not particularly strong, I want this person standing behind me to say, hey, buck up, come on. You've got a better role, better responsibility, a higher level to perform at and to help you along. And we're only one verse into the description here. Those whom God approves must conduct themselves in a blameless manner, doing what is right in his eyes. In order to take up residence in God's house, a person must cast off everything that does not fit with God's description here. So often in the Bible, what we see is a list of don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. This is unacceptable. This is not going to fly. And here what we're seeing is a list of this is what you should do. This is what you must do. This is how you should sound and how you should look and when you should stand up for somebody else. Regardless of whether it's the negative side of don't or the positive side of do, what we see is a list here that we need to consider and that we know that God considers if he's going to have a family member dwell in his holy hill. I talked about the fact that we need to jettison. Sometimes you see people talk about these great sculptors and they say, well, how do you make that block of marble look like that? And they've said before that, well, I have a picture in my head, and I start chipping away everything that doesn't look like the end product I want. And that's what we need to do as we look at this list and say, this is what that person's going to look like. I want to make my unrefined self look closer to that. Turn to Ephesians 4, verse 22. Ephesians 4, verse 22. With this concept of casting off or jettisoning anything that doesn't look like Psalm 15, we can support that concept of casting off or putting off here in Ephesians 4 and verse 22. We'll read a number of verses here beginning in verse 22, and it says, "For you ought to put off the old man," it says, "according to the way of life that you used to participate in, the way that you were living before. Put off the old man who is corrupt according to deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind." We talked earlier about the person in their mind, in their heart, at their core, they speak truth. They're a person of righteousness and dependability. So be renewed in the spirit of your mind at your very core. And you should put on the new man who, according to God, was created in righteousness and true holiness. We said this person in verse 2 is a person of upright character, a person that works righteousness. So verse 24 here tells us that we ought to be renewed using the spirit that God has developed from that standpoint. And verse 25 says, "Therefore, putting away lying, let each man speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another." And we know that we're all striving to be members of God's family, dwelling on his holy hill. Let's move on to verse 3. What other qualities does this champion possess? We talked about the fact that this person is going to be a poster child. They're going to be a champion. They're going to be that ideal scenario. What other qualities does this person possess? Verse 3 says that, and I'll read through the whole verse and then we'll come back and look at the pieces. Verse 3 says, "He that backbites not with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his neighbor." That first term, the term here used for backbite, means to slander. It talks about somebody who's a talebearer. It talks about somebody who spies out opportunity. You know, there's a song, this would be something a little newer than 1974, but it's entitled Dirty Laundry, and it talks about the fact that everybody likes dirty laundry. That's what the news focuses on. That's what the tabloids focus on. What type of dirt, what type of garbage, what type of interesting gossip can we dig up on people around? You may recall, I know Mr. Lambert gave it in Buffalo several weeks ago, and whether he gave it here, a sermonette, and he used those words from a song about digging up bones, unearthing things that are better left alone. That's what this individual would do. This individual is just looking for an opportunity to say, you know what I heard? Guess what I saw so-and-so doing? And yet it says that this person, in verse 3, it says, "He that backbites not with his tongue." Exodus 23 and verse 1. Exodus 23 and verse 1 has something to say about this. Backbiting not with your tongue. Don't be that busybody. Don't be that person who's looking to dig it up and pass it on and keep it alive. Exodus 23 and verse 1, it says, "You shall not raise a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil." It's easy to follow a crowd. It's easy to be tempted into taking the easy route out, to be unwilling to step into that gap and take the heat for somebody else. But it says, "Do not follow a multitude to do evil. Neither shall you speak in a cause in order to follow many, in order to wrest judgment." So there's a proper judgment. There's a proper end to things. There's a proper decision and a moral decision to be made. But very often the group says, you know what, that's not in our best interest. And therefore, what they try to do is they try to wrest or twist that judgment to serve their purpose, to enrich their lives, to make them more comfortable or have an easier case of things. And so it says, you shall not go there. You shall not be pushed off center by those around you. Don't let the bad behavior of others mislead you. We can read in 1 Corinthians 15:33. It says, "Do not be deceived." Again, 1 Corinthians 15:33. "Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits." So we, as we strive to strengthen ourselves, as we as we as we try to cast off the issues and buff up the strengths that we have that look like Psalm 15, we need to make sure that we're not spending time. Why would we go to the effort of trying to fix and improve and yet be hanging with the crowd that's going to make that harder and harder? We need to be, again, jettisoning the things that don't look like Psalm 15, hanging with a better crowd, spending time in our Bible and on our knees to make sure that we're developing that type of character that God's looking for, his model citizen. In Leviticus 19 and verse 16, Leviticus chapter 19 and verse 16, we're talking about this person that doesn't backbite or slander or talebear or spy out or gossip. Leviticus 19 and verse 16, it says, "You shall not go as a slanderer among your people." And there are those that do that. They are those busybodies we talked about. They kind of slink through the crowd. They're keeping their ear to the conversation that's going on, and they're saying, "You know what I heard?" And sometimes what they heard was only half of the statement. But you know, when you walk in midway through a conversation, and you're like, "Whoa, there must be a reason that the conversation sounded like what I heard right here," because you didn't have the context. And people that, well, I can take what I heard, and actually I like just the piece. That's what I want to pass along. So I'm not looking for the truth. I just want to use it in the context in which I heard it, because they're those busybodies. And it says, "You shall not," where was I here again? "You shall not go as a slanderer among your people. You shall not stand against the blood of your neighbor. I am the Lord." So he says, "I'm telling you, this is what you do and what you don't do. And I'm telling you because I am the Lord." You know, it's like when your kids, you tell your kids to do something, you're trying to get them to perform better. And they say, "Why?" And you said, "Because I'm the dad. And I said so." And that's what he's saying here. There's a way to perform. There is that model citizen that I want to dwell with, the kids that I want, the character and fiber that I'm looking for. And I'm telling you, it's because that's who I am, how I am, and what I require of the family around me. Let's drop back to verse 15, still in Leviticus 19 here. So it says, "Don't go about through the people as a slanderer." But in verse 15, it says, "You shall do," so this takes it a step further. Slandering and that talebearer is a rather narrow thing and a particular practice. But it comes back and it says, "You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment." So when you have the opportunity, when you're in that position of authority, you shall do no unrighteousness. "You shall not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty." So what it's saying here is, regardless of who it is, there's a right way. There is a moral judgment to be made. And I don't care whether it's a poor person who's a friend of yours. You don't use it, what did it say earlier, to wrest judgment, to twist the decision. There's a right decision to be made. And I don't care if that person is the rich person with authority that may be able to give you a marker or do you a favor and make your life easier in the future. Regardless of which extreme there might be, under no circumstances do you deviate from the proper judgment. So shall not respect the person of the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty, but you shall judge your neighbor in righteousness. All people, all situations, based on the direction of God and the instruction of God and the lists of the do's and don'ts of God, because that's where we need to base our righteousness in. Let's turn a little further ahead in the book of Psalms for a moment while we're on the subject of our speech. Psalm 34, we'll begin in verse 11. Psalm 34, it says, you know, the tongue is desperately wicked and it's a difficult thing to control sometimes. You know, we've had sermons and messages lately about, again, digging up bones, digging up trouble, digging up things that hopefully people have repented of and buried and moved on. We've talked about, we've had a sermon about being a gossip and making sure that we're not contributing to that. Sometimes even unknowingly, we're not the busybody, but we say something that we heard that we haven't yet had the opportunity to confirm or disprove. And so we need to actively be thinking about each comment we're making. Is it made in real truth, knowledgeable truth? Would we be able to put our name on that and say, "I know this to be true, I can say it in fact," or is it something that, which, well, I heard this and I pass it along, not with intent, but without the intent to be cautious. And so we really, this is a very active thing as we look at our character. Psalm chapter 34 and verse 11, it says, "Come, listen to me, my sons. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. I will teach you the respect of the Lord, the admiration of God." And through that comes the teaching and the depth and the character that we develop through those teachings. Let's pick it up again in verse 13. It says, I'm going to teach you. Come listen to me. And then it goes on to say, verse 13, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking guile. You know, once you open that and start flapping it, it's something that you can't take back. So don't even get there. Keep your tongue from evil and your lip from speaking guile. Verse 14, depart from evil and do good. Seek peace and pursue it. There's another one of our well-known hymns. Seek peace, pursue it, depart from evil and do good. And why is it that we should behave in such a righteous manner? Verse 15 says, for the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their cry. Verse 16, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil, to cut off the memory of them from the earth. The person referred to in verse 3 here will not take advantage of their neighbor, nor do them wrong by speaking poorly of them. One of the commentaries said they are especially careful not to injure a neighbor in his good name. Though many who would not otherwise wrong their neighbors make nothing of that. You know, I have very nice neighbors. I don't have very many of them because we live out in the country and that's what we were looking for. But right across the street, we have very nice neighbors. And I have no doubt that they would not come over into my driveway and steal my car. I am 100% absolutely sure that they wouldn't do that. And most of our neighbors wouldn't. But how many neighbors, it says here, they would not otherwise wrong their neighbors, but they think nothing of injuring their neighbor's good name because they talk about what somebody did. Oh, by the way, did you hear? When that would be better off covered. What does it say? Love covers that multitude of sins. This is something that doesn't need to be repeated. This is something that does nobody any good, and therefore I'm not going to. He or she defends against the temptation to handle evil news about a neighbor, meaning they won't receive it. You know, it's, well, you know what I heard? You know what? Keep it to yourself. Put it back in your pocket. I don't need it. I got plenty going on in my life, and you know what? I think they're pretty nice people, and so, you know, if it's true, I don't need to dwell on it. If it's not, neither one of us should be talking about it. So they won't receive that type of news. They won't ponder it and think about it and worry about it, and they certainly won't pass it on. It said back in... what was it? Back in Psalm 34:13, keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking guile. Depart from evil and do good. So that's what this person does. Remember, as we move on through these brief series of verses and the values we see here, that we want to ask ourselves again and again. You may get sick of the question by the time I'm done here, but if that person could be built, that ideal person, that model citizen, what would they look like and how would they act? Because it should be important to us as it is important to God. Psalm 15 gives us a tangible list of everyday qualities that we can see, that we can appreciate and trumpet in the lives of others, and that we should be developing in our own lives. Marriage, honesty, so many things in this world have fallen by the wayside, and we bemoan that fact. But we can be looking out for the good and making sure that we're developing it in our lives. Let's move on to verse 4. Verse 4, what does this person look like? How do they sound? How do they act? In whose eyes a vile person is condemned. I want to jump back to the beginning here where it said in verse, this was in the revised, the RSV. It says, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised. In the King James, it says, in whose eyes a vile person is condemned. But he honors them that fear the Lord. And this is a person that swears to their own hurt and changes not. So that's what we see in verse 4. This world, and again, I'm talking about the overall moral compass. I've gotten myself in trouble a couple of times when I make these carte blanche statements about the world. There are a lot of fine people in this world. And there are people that, you know, maybe they're being drawn to God and we can look at their character and we can see some things that, you know, the Spirit appears to be working on with them. And we can't always discern that, so we have to be very careful about making those snap judgments or those carte blanche judgments. So I talk about the moral compass of this world in general. And, you know, the world has gone soft on nearly every bastion of righteousness. You know, whether we talk about marriage, whether we talk about integrity, honesty, we talk about dependability and courtesy and loyalty and that type of thing, we see less and less and less of it. When somebody holds the door for someone, it's like, wow, that was nice. We don't see that very often. Something that not many years ago was just the standard. Everybody, they fought over, you know, who was, no, you first. You know, Mrs. Shepherd, you know, a guy is supposed to hold the door for a lady. But you know what? She's more than one. She's beat me to that door, and she holds that door for me, and she's not going to let me take it out of her hand. You know, that's her little act of integrity that she likes to say, you know what? This is not reserved just for a boy. And she would look at something like Psalm 15 and said, I am just as much that person as you. And you know what? She's absolutely right. Probably more so. But those little things that people used to do for each other that we don't see that many times or that often anymore. An upright person is not swayed in their judgment by opportunity for gain. And we see that in verse 4 here. Or a man's position or rank, they recognize the values of those that cling to what we hold dear, the ways that God has taught us. The godly person does not tolerate moral corruption. It says here, in whose eyes a vile person or a reprobate is condemned. They disdain those that act wickedly. He walks by the rules of righteousness and truth, and scorns and abhors the gains of injustice and fraud. From one of the commentaries, the godly person does not tolerate moral corruption. So what we're doing is, the only way you cannot tolerate it is if you know what it is. The practice is there, the study is there, and the list is in our heads, or it's on our wall, or it's, you know, inside the, you know, you open the drawer of your desk. I know many of you have Bibles in your desks at home, and I know many of you probably have them in your desk at work, and it's that opportunity when you have the opportunity to close the door and say, you know what, it's been a tough morning, and I need to kind of get myself back on track. The person does not tolerate moral corruption in their lives, nor in those around them. Because this person adheres to divine standards, he looks with disdain upon those that act wickedly. He walks by the rules of righteousness and truth, and scorns and abhors the gains of injustice and fraud. We're careful not to stand in the midst of sinners. You know, it says, he who does not walk with and does not stand in and does not sit down in their presence. We recognize that we need to keep ourselves from the edge. You know, if a riot breaks out and the police start grabbing bodies, if you're standing in the middle, you're accounted as a participant. And so what we do is we remove ourselves from that. We have to be careful not to let the filth of the world around tarnish our lives and our reputation as a disciple of Jesus Christ. We need to recoil from the contemptible person and be sure that factors such as wealth and influence and position don't sway us. At the same time, it talks about this person is quick to recognize and to appreciate and to encourage those that act in a godly way. We hold to those higher qualities, those higher standards that God has given us, and we regard and esteem those that live their lives according to those standards. Even if that person is not somebody who's religious. I know a lot of wonderful people who don't attend church with us or anywhere else, but they were raised good people. And so we encourage and we recognize and we give them a pat on the back when they do something well, because it's an example that all of us should follow. And so as we try to set our example, when we see our children do something well, when we see our neighbor do something well, we tell them about that. We recognize and we appreciate what they do to make sure that we encourage that to develop further, instead of just saying, that was nice, but I walked away and didn't say anything about it. Therefore, that person was not encouraged. They weren't elevated by my standards and by my recognition. It says here that this person shows recognition and honor to those that live according to or act according to one of the standards of God's. People often talk about how in the olden days that a man's word was his bond, and it talks about this person being that type of person. You know, in the past, and I was talking about somebody this week, in the past we didn't need a horde of lawyers to come with us to develop a contract and to cover our backsides about every particular thing that would have gone wrong. When you looked somebody in the eye and you shook their hand and you came to an agreement, you knew what the end result was going to be. And you knew that through the steps of that activity, until you brought it to fruition, you were going to act according to your word, according to the standards of good quality, both in relationship and in product. And so if I did something wrong, it was my job to make it right. I had that accountability. I had that responsibility. We had that job to do. And if an accident happened and it really was nobody's fault, people worked together and they said, you know what? Okay, yeah, I'm not going to push this on you. And we see so much of that today. My contract says that you're going to perform this way until this date, until I have what I want. And you know what? You're responsible for everything that goes wrong, regardless of cost. And, And I'm, you know, I'm going to hold you to it, and I'm going to stick it to you in every way until we get what I want. And that's what we need to, wait a minute. No, it says that righteousness needs to be done. That you don't take advantage of the poor. You don't pay homage to the rich. There's a right thing to do. There's a right way to interact. And we work together to get that done. And if it means that we need to share a little bit of cost, we need to share a little bit of pain. Again, what David asked in the opening question was, what will your person look like? And that's a deep and profound and complete question. So today, something goes wrong that's going to cost me a few bucks, or it's going to set me back a couple of weeks. I don't look at this transaction as an end. I ask the question of Psalm 15:1, and then I act on this transaction based on that description. And therefore, if it means I shoulder a little bit of pain or a few dollars worth right now, I want God to be looking back and saying, you know what? If he were to expand on Psalm 15 and he would say, you know, according to the way that so-and-so acted in that situation and so-and-so acted in that situation, they all meld, they all fulfill Psalm 15. It says here that this person's word, this model citizen of Psalm 15, can be trusted. The commentaries describe a sense of responsibility and reputation that once this person makes an agreement, a promise, a contract, they will be bound by that even if they later realize that it will cause them serious disadvantage. You know, I sometimes am amazed today at what people can sell on eBay and what other people are willing to pay great value for that I would look at and go, I'm just cleaning my garage. I just want it out of my garage. And yet people will pay to fill their garage with it. But you know what? If you offer to sell something to somebody, not knowing the value, let's say you had a painting somehow and you didn't know it, you know, and as they peel it back or as they take it off, they realize there's some Monet under there. And you're like, oh, that thing, I could have built a new house with that picture. But if this person had put their hand to it, if they had committed to the fact, I have an agreement, I agreed to it, and if after the fact I find out that it's going to cause me serious disadvantage, I still made a contract. I had an agreement. I agreed to do something, and I follow through with that because my character that God's looking down on is more important than the addition I could have put on my house or the nicer car that I could put in my garage. That talks about the character of that person. Because when that transaction, as I mentioned, is done, and that is set aside, and we're no longer looking at that, you know what? When I need to call on someone to dig me out of a problem, or I need to give my children into somebody's hands to take care of, I want someone who's going to say, you know what? I'll take your children, and I'll make sure that I return them safe at such and such a time. And there is no question in my mind. Did their boss say, hey, come on, I get this big party and Bills game I'm going to go to. And now they're going, oh, wow, man, that would set me up with a boss. And they're going to have great food. They're going to be in one of those luxury boxes. And I got to see if I can dish the Regord kids off on someone else to take care of me. No, that person is going to say, you know what, I got to pass on a great opportunity because I put my stamp, I put my agreement, I put my agreement out to that person. That's the model citizen that God brings us to see the picture of in Psalm 15. We need to be those people of honor, brethren, if we hope to dwell with God as his sons and daughters, something that we pray will happen very soon. Of course, we can consider the very greatest example, and we should consider the very greatest example of commitment that we see in the person of Jesus Christ. As he approached that day, as he approached the event that was probably the most painful, the most ugly physical situation that any person could go through, you know, he went to the garden and he prayed. And he asked Father, he said, perhaps there is some other way. And yet, knowing that there wasn't, and without that booming voice to say, you know what, I'm glad that you carried through this far, but you know, there is in fact an easier way to do this. There wasn't that voice. There wasn't that option. And therefore, he committed to and carried through with the greatest promise that was ever made so that that promise and that future could be played out for all of us. And that's why we sit here, and that's why we look forward to that promise and being one of those model citizens on God's holy hill. We've often read the scripture that there is no greater love than to lay down one's life for a friend, and that is commitment. That is honesty and integrity and loyalty and discipline. Let's move on to verse 5. Verse 5, as we wrap up the last of these 99 words. Verse 5 says, "He that puts not out his money to usury, nor takes reward against the innocent, he that does these things shall never be moved." So we read here the last couple of ingredients, if you will, facets of this person's character, and then we have the closing promise that's made. This person shall never be moved. As we look at the various verses, we've seen a number of situations where this model citizen interacts with people around him. In situations such in verse 2, we see a general picture of character. It says that the person walks uprightly. So in the whole realm of their character, on Monday through Sunday and this year through that year, this person is going to walk uprightly. They're going to work righteousness. They're going to speak truth from their heart. We see the general scope of this individual's character. In other verses, such as in verse 3, we see how this person would react and should react to a specific situation where gossip comes up. We know that gossip is a type of verbal poison, and that this person that would be invited to live with God would not participate in such an activity. So we see specific situations as well in these few verses. In verse 3, we also saw that this person has the ability to judge the character of others as God would, because we know that he would not dwell with sin. This person recognizes the person who deals in a godly manner, and he removes himself. It says that he condemns that person that is a reprobate and acts in that ungodly manner. But here in verse 5, we see another side of this character in the fact that the individual will not take advantage of others, even though there might be great personal benefit or gain to be had. God has a great deal to say about taking advantage of others, and we'll turn to a verse in Exodus 22 here, especially when those that are taken advantage are disadvantaged to begin with. Let's turn to Exodus 22 and verse 22. Exodus chapter 22 and verse 22. Remembering, as you're turning there, remembering, it says that verse 5 here of Psalm 15, "He that puts not out his money to usury, nor takes reward against the innocent." So what we're looking at, again, is somebody who will not take advantage of others. Exodus chapter 22 and verse 22 says, "You shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If you afflict them in any way and they cry out at all to me, I will surely hear their cry, and my wrath shall become hot, and I will kill you with a sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your sons fatherless." We know that God has great love for all of mankind. We know that he set in place from the very beginning that his holy son would die for the sins of all mankind. We know that the Bible says that his plan is for every human being to have the opportunity to know him and to understand his law and to understand the future that he holds out, and then to take advantage of that promise and that invitation. And he wishes that none should perish. But we see here that those in need, those who are taken advantage of, have a very special place in his heart. Let's continue in verse 25. We'll continue in verse 25, because here it addresses the two particular points that were made here in verse 5 of Psalm 15. So here in Exodus 22 and verse 25, it says, "If you lend money to one of my people who is poor beside you, you shall not be to him as a moneylender, neither shall you lay upon him interest." And there's really two points made here. The first one talks about not being a moneylender, not lending money at usury. And the definition for usury is the act of lending money with a charge of interest for its use. That first piece is something that's not unusual. And we know, most of us have mortgages or have taken a business loan or something like that and pay interest on it. But more generally, the term usury means to lend at an unconscionable rate or an exorbitant rate of interest, and in fact at a level in excess of the legal rate that's allowed. There is law that says that you will not exceed a certain point. And it says here, do not lend as a money lender. So we see in the first part of verse 5 that this person would not take advantage by charging excessively. And that, of course, is consistent with everything else that we've seen in the chapter so far. But it goes further and shows that they would be benevolent when they can. It says in the second part, it says, neither lay up, this is of verse 25, it says, neither shall you lay interest upon him. That circles back to the first part of the verse where it says, if you lend money to one of my people who is poor beside you. So business transactions happen between us and the world and us, and sometimes between us. And often we have said we have to be very careful, we have to be discerning, we have to be wise about that, because business among family and business among friends can often be a great point of irritation. But it talks about the fact that lending money, if somebody is going to take an opportunity and they're going to increase their wealth from a transaction, I'm going to buy a field, I'm going to cultivate it, I'm going to make money off that crop, the person who lends them the money to buy that field is not prevented from charging interest. They can share in the gain of that opportunity. You know, if I were to buy a herd or a flock or something like that and then develop them and sell them and make money on that, the person who helped back me and get me into that transaction has the right to share in the gain. So it doesn't say that you shall never lend at interest. But it says if the person is poor and you're in a position to be able to help and to be a benefactor, that's the type of model citizen that would dwell with me down through time. So we have to be careful that we don't just say, right there, you have, I need, and you shouldn't charge me interest. That's not what it says here. So we need to understand what is being said. But it says, when you have the opportunity to be a benefactor, to help somebody get back on their feet, and the position seems wise, and the person appears to be that person of character, again, we've seen people come in and take advantage of support mechanisms and that type of thing, and that's not right on their side. But again, what we're talking about here is this person in verse 5 who would not lend at usury, would not take advantage, would not get rich at the expense of someone else. Verse 5 also points out, there's a second point, so we've covered the lending and the usury side, but it also says in verse 5, let me back up a couple pages and read that, it says, nor take reward against the innocent. So we've got the lending concept out, but it goes on to say, here that the person would also not take a reward against the innocent, and that operative word, the important word here, is against. The receipt of a gift is not inherently bad. And again, if you've made dinner for a neighbor and next time they come to your house, they bring you a bottle of wine, housewarming gift, those things are natural and those things are appreciated. They're things that we do to show respect and love and admiration and appreciation. If you've been in business, vendors sometimes give you gifts, and they said, you know what, you've done an incredible amount of business with me this year, and I want to show my appreciation for that. So here's a gift basket, or here's an opportunity, a couple of concert tickets. Those things are not inherently wrong. So the fact that verse 5 says, would not take a reward, what we have to read the full context of is that they would not take a reward against the innocent. Against is the operative word. Because if a gift is given with the intent to sway a decision, we read earlier about the fact that you shall not twist that righteous decision, that moral judgment, to the poor or to the rich. So if a gift is given with that intent, the person who gives it with that intent has sinned because they're looking to sway a decision, not based on the performance of it, but I give, therefore thou must give. I'm looking to twist. And the person that receives it with the intent and the understanding that that's what it was for sins on the other side of that. So we have a balance that's equally bad when something is given with the intent of being against righteousness. Again, this is done with the intent of harming the righteous, and God gives that type of practice no quarter. Exodus 23, we've been in Exodus a couple of times, as we hear the law of God, we hear the intent of how he says, you shall perform in this way amongst you. Here in Exodus 23 and verse 8, it says that you shall take no bribe, for the bribe blinds the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. And we saw earlier in Psalm 15 that that person would not be swayed to either extreme. They would toe the line and they would follow the standard and apply the rule. Many people in positions of authority or sometimes purely out of opportunity, have done that type of thing. You know what? I'll turn a blind eye this time on the code or whatever it is. I'll let you get away with it. But you know what? I'm going to come back to you at some point. I've got my little notebook as far as who I did favors for, and I'm going to expect you to bend the rules at some point on my behalf. People have taken the opportunity to get favors or enrich their lives, but the son or daughter of God that would live with him, that would be that model citizen, would not do such a thing. Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 19. Again, we're talking about bribes. We're talking about taking that reward against the innocent, or taking a reward against what would be a just judgment or a righteous judgment. Deuteronomy chapter 16 and verse 19. You shall not pervert judgment. You shall not respect persons, nor take a gift. So again, individually, taking that gift is not an issue. But it says, when it comes to judgment, you shall not take a gift in order to show respect or deference. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. We read from an earlier verse in Psalm 15 that God's model citizen would swear to their own hurt. They would not bend this, whether it's costing them dollars today for a transaction or whether it's costing them the opportunity to take advantage and come out better on the other end. They would not change that righteousness. They would swear to their own hurt, and they would be consistent. And that would be consistent with the person that God's looking to have dwell with them. We all have hymnals close by. Take your hymnal, if you would, and turn to page 10. I mentioned the fact earlier that this is one of the hymns that we sing, one of the very well-known ones that we sing. And it's entitled, Who Shall Dwell on Thy Holy Hill? And I'm going to ask Mr. Lambert to sing this a cappella. No, I'm not. I know I could hear him from the back of the room, and therefore, no. If you look at the second verse, third stanza, so the third set of lines down and the second verse, I like the way it talks about you shall not take a bribe. You shall not let temptation twist your decision. And it says here, it says, who will claim no usury, nor with bribes pollute his hand. It says here that a bribe blinds the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Here it says, when you accept that bribe, you're defiled. Your hand is polluted. And we know that God will not dwell with them. We know that he does not dwell with sin. And so if we get back to the opening question, it says, Father, what does this person sound like? What does this person look like? What does this person act like to you? And he said, they won't be invited to my holy hill if their hands are polluted, if they have the blood of the innocent because of the trying to enrich themselves. I like the way that talks about pollute their hand or defile their hand. We're in Deuteronomy 16, verse 19. Let's go on to verse 20. It says, you shall follow that which is altogether just. You know, it talked about not taking a bribe. Verse 20 says, you shall follow that which is altogether just, that you may live and inherit the land which the Lord your God gives you. So there was, we read earlier in Genesis, where there was that covenant made with Abraham. And he said, if you will walk before me and be this perfect type of person that is later brought to us in Psalm 15, then I will multiply the seed and I will bless you. And again, here in Deuteronomy, we say that if you shall follow that which is altogether just, then you shall live and inherit the land which the Lord your God gives you. On a physical standpoint, there will be blessing to the person who deals from a righteous standpoint. And we know that there's always the other side of that. There's the righteous, there's the perpetual, there's the eternal side of that character. The psalm concludes with the assurance that the person doing the things listed here should not be moved or shaken. And the commentary makes it clear that this promise is perpetual in nature. So, you know, we can look at the fact that if we have a particular transaction, I've talked about it from that standpoint, and say, you know, I have a decision to make today, and I could be pulled, somebody may be pulled to make that decision on behalf of a friend. It's funny, I gave this in Buffalo last week, and I was just thinking about it through the week and mulling it over my head to make sure that I had it, and it brought back to me a memory of about 15 years, 18 years ago, when I worked for a company that was a global operation. It was a Dutch parent company, and what they would do is about every year and a half or so, they would bring the CFOs of the companies the vice president of finance, that type of thing. They would bring all those financial decision makers together at some place throughout the world. And usually it was over in Europe, the Netherlands, Frankfurt. We got to go to Paris one time. But one of the very first meetings we had, and I couldn't even remember exactly what the basis of the question was, but I think they were just working on that team building skills and getting to know each other. And they came up with a question. They said, if you were driving with one of your associates here and they hit somebody and killed somebody with a car, would you lie on their behalf? And for some reason, they focused me out, and I'm trying to remember what his name was. But Hans was the guy that he said, Marcus, if you were riding with Hans and he was driving and he made an error and he killed somebody, but it really wasn't his fault, would you lie on his behalf? And I said, no. Oh, his life is in your hands. All you need to do is say no, and you know, he's going to go. And they were trying to build the fact that we're all part of a team and we're supposed to work together. And so I'm supposed to lie for the guy? So, you know, here's what it says, is that this world so much says, wait a minute, you're part of this team. No, we're part of this team, and we're part of God's family. And we're asking the question, who would be invited to dwell on his holy hill? As he peels back the outside of the character of each and every one of us, does he see these core qualities and ingredients there? Would you lie on behalf of somebody else? Somebody did wrong. Somebody made a mistake. Somebody has a responsibility. But you know what? I'm going to twist that righteous judgment on behalf of a friend or somebody who's wealthy. It says, no, you have a righteous judgment to make. It was how that came back to me from 15 years ago, but it did. And it, you know, and then for the next 4 days conference that we're there, you know, no, his name wasn't Hans, it was Max. So Max would come up and he goes, thanks, Regord. And it would get a chuckle from the whole crew and all, but I'm thinking, you know what? So here's the pressure. Okay, I can't depend on Regord. I'm thinking, wait a minute. It's exactly the opposite. You can depend on the person who is righteous, because that person is going to always do the right, not the convenient, not for your personal benefit, but you can always depend on their basis for decision. How I got off on that, I don't know. But the commentary, again, makes it clear that this promise, it says that you shall not be moved, is perpetual in nature. It isn't a guarantee that no trials will befall us. It says, you know, time and chance happens to all men. But we know that time and chance happens and that God will hear and watch over those. It said earlier, if you take advantage of the orphan or of the widow, I hear the righteous and I will deliver them out of their plight when they call to me. And that's what it says. God hears. And he will prevent the worst from happening. He will take us out of those that could truly move us or truly shake us. The concept here is that this person has been admitted into God's presence and will continue to enjoy his favor, blessing, and aid. The commentaries explain that temptation shall not overcome him. So again, situations will arise, but temptation shall not overcome him. Trouble shall not overwhelm him. Nothing shall rob him of his present peace, nor his future blessing. So we recognize that those challenges and those temptations and sometimes those outright wrongs will happen to us. But we have a sense of present peace because we know from where we operate, and we know that where we operate is the gold standard that God has, and therefore we know that our future blessing is secure as well. David states again in the following chapter, we've been reading from Psalm 15. In Psalm 16, verse 8 and 9, he states this. You know, we're talking about this last point about this person shall not be moved. They shall not be shaken. David, in Psalm 16, verse 8, it says, I have set the Lord always before me. So I keep God before me in my thoughts, in my practice, in my prayers, in my study, in my daily musings, which he was doing here in Psalm 15. And because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. So because God is at arm's length, because God is always in my thoughts, because he surrounds me and protects me, as we talked, Mr. Teague talked about the fact, move this stuff aside and operate for extended periods or for brief periods through the extended day inside God's bubble and say, okay, put this pressure away, put that distraction away, just wait a minute. There's that present peace, and it's because of the future promise I have. And what is the product of that stability? In verse 9, It says, therefore, my heart is glad and my glories rejoice. And in fact, my flesh also shall rest in hope. So when we can do that, the temptations and the difficulties and the pressure and the heat comes, but we're able to push that off. I know I have a strength greater than that. God, you know, what's it say? What can man do to you? When I stand in your corner, you got it made. The point is made for us again in the book of 2 Peter. Let's turn to 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5. 2 Peter 1 and verse 5, Peter writes this letter to encourage the church. It warns about false teachers that are finding their way into the church. And beginning in verse 5, we see another list of character traits that I'm certain our model citizen would have in spades. Again, 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5. And we're going to focus on a particular verse or two, a couple down the road. But again, we're talking about a list, what the person does and doesn't do or have, or how they act and how they sound. 2 Peter 1 and verse 5, it says, and besides this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue. So it goes through a list of things here. And again, when you talk about faith and virtue and integrity, and those are things that you kind of, you got to simplify, you got to break down, and then you got to say, okay, how do they look and how do I show them? How do I take what I've learned and how do I act on it? Add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and godliness, and brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness charity. For if these things, if this list of things, and we've been looking at a list in Psalm 15, for if these things be in you and abound, they make you that you shall neither be barren nor unfruitful in the knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. But he that lacks these things is blind, and he cannot see far off. He gets caught up in those transactions. He gets caught up in today because he's short-sighted. He can't see far off. Talks about the present peace and the future blessing. The person can't see that end result, that future blessing. He that lacks these things is blind and cannot see afar off and has forgotten that he was purged from his old sins. We talked earlier about the fact that we need to cast off those things that don't sound like and look like Psalm 15. I'd like to focus on verse 10 and verse 11. Verse 10 says, wherefore the rather, brethren, give diligence to make your calling and election sure. For if you do these things, you shall never fall. We talked about the fact this Psalm 15 person doing these things, living this way, being this person of integrity, this model citizen of God's holy hill, this person shall never be moved. Here's the confirmation of the promise that we read at the close of Psalm 15. And let's read one verse farther because this passage brings it full circle back to the beginning, actually, of Psalm 15. Remember that the opening question that David asked in Psalm 15 was, Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who will abide perpetually, long term? Who will have that intimate relationship with you down through eternity? Who shall dwell in your holy hill? What type of person will you bring close to you perpetually? Well, if you live this way, if you possess these qualities, then you're God's type of person. And it says in verse 11, then an entrance shall be ministered unto you abundantly into the everlasting kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. That person shall not move, and they will have that perpetual promise. They will have that guaranteed invitation to dwell on God's holy hill. Halley's Bible Handbook has a very succinct comment on Psalm 15. If any of you have Halley's Bible Handbook, it's a relatively small handbook, maybe about that thick, and it goes through the different chapters and verses of the Bible, and it brings out historical details, or it talks about the particular character that a particular passage speaks about. And it has six words here. In regard to Psalm 15, it says, the righteous, truthful, just, and honest. That list that we see in Psalm 15 describes a person who is righteous, truthful, just, and honest. 99 words, 5 verses that we can stack ourselves against any day, any particular transaction, any particular conversation, any particular decision. Thomas Jefferson called this psalm the picture of a true gentleman. I'd like to ask Mr. Close, I've pulled him 2 weeks in a row to do this, I'd like to ask him to hand out something to everybody. And when you get it, I'm going to ask you to keep it face down. There should be plenty for everybody here today, and I'd like you to keep it face down while he gives that to you. We're all going to turn on a little bit more to say here, and then we're going to turn it over in a couple of minutes, and it's something that you can take home with you to try to remember, hopefully, the message and the concept that we've gone over here today. We all know that we have a goal before us to become perfect. We read earlier in Genesis, I almost said January again, in Genesis 17, that Abram, later Abraham, was to walk before God and be perfect. We can also read that in Matthew 5:48. It says, we're told to become perfect or complete as our Father in heaven is perfect. Again, Matthew 5:48. And we're to develop into the perfect man to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. We read that in Ephesians 4:13. So it talks about the Father being perfect, complete, without blemish. Remember we read that earlier about that person who walks in right uprightly. And it talks about the Son being a mirror image of his Father. Brethren, we're to strive, to strain, to stretch toward the kingdom of God each day. And one of the ways we can do that is to hold ourselves up to the description that we see in Psalm 15. And in countless other passages that we read throughout our Bible. But Psalm 15 is a succinct one that we can fit on a page, that we can keep in our thoughts, and that we can keep with us. As part of the introduction, I read to you the prayer of General Douglas MacArthur entitled, Build Me a Son. Well, we know in effect that's exactly what God is doing. He is building sons and daughters. He's developing the internal character that's going to bring us to a point that he fulfills that invitation, that future promise to join him in his kingdom. He's building or developing sons and daughters. He's seeking to expand his family of two. Does everybody have a copy of the handout? Go ahead and turn it over. The very first verse of Psalm 15 asks the question, Lord, who will sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill? If we work at Psalm 15, brethren, take a good look.